Hello, everyone. It's Crystal here, one of your hosts for IATSE891's podcast, Applebox Talks. It's been nearly 2 years since we released an episode of the podcast, and for many of us, a lot has changed in that time. Our industry, our people, have come through an incredibly challenging 2 years, and now we take stock of how we want to move forward with this work in the future. We're hoping to release Season 2 of Applebox Talks in 2025. Season 1 introduced you to some of the creative artists and technicians that make up the membership here and gave you a peek behind the curtain with our episodes focused on helping those new to the industry learn more about what it means to be a part of our local. In Season 2, we want to take a step back, looking more broadly at IATSE 891's role in both the motion picture industry and the greater labor movement here in BC. We're really excited about the upcoming interviews and the stories we will get to share with you in 2025. In the meantime, we've gone back to our archive and edited 6 previously unaired episodes from Season 1, and we'll be releasing those monthly for the rest of 2024. Since they were recorded in 2022, there are a few dated references, but there's still some excellent stories for you. So until we see you fresh again in 2025, pull up an Applebox and let's talk. IATSE 891 presents Applebox Talks,
the podcast where we get to talk to the very best in entertainment, the artists and technicians of IATSE 891.
From prep to post and everything in between, we create worlds on screens of all sizes.
Welcome to Applebox Talks. I'm Hillary.
And I'm Crystal, and this week we are joined by the department who brings the details of the story to life on screen, with credits to their name, such as 7 years in Tibet, Snow Falling on Cedars, Watchmen, and the BFG.
This week, taking their seat on the Applebox is a property master and member of the props department, Jimmy Chow. So let's pull up an Applebox and let's talk.
Welcome, Jimmy. Thank you for coming.
Thank you. This Applebox is quite comfortable.
The name of the podcast came about because, you know, how everyone's standing around on set all day and then some gracious grip pulls up an Applebox and says, how about you have a seat? And then, you know, conversation ensues.
So, Jimmy, how would you describe your job in the motion picture industry?
I would describe it as being exhilarating, a lot of challenges, fun, and hopefully quite poignant to help tell the story if I do the props correctly.
You are what we would call a veteran of this industry. So you've seen it grow and change over the years. And just take us through where you started and where you are now.
Well, it's been a long journey. And the film industry was probably going to be my third career. I was in retail and I was always in the arts and the music and theater. And I thought, well, what am I going to do now? I'll try social work. And it was rewarding, but I found out dealing with the bureaucracy and social work in the government, it just wasn't my calling. So I was looking for something else. And friends of mine were working at BCTV, and one person was working at CBC. And they said, why don't you apply? And I said, oh, okay. So I applied, and I got a call. And they asked me to come down to work. I said, oh, great. Yeah, it was Christmas Eve. And I ended up cleaning Bob Fortune's blackboard. I did such a great job that they called me back again a week later, and it was New Year's Eve. So I guess that's why I got the job. And I got a job at the CBC as a stagehand. I did graphics, and I was doing set decoration. And then a position came open for a TV series called Beachcombers. I kind of liked film. I'd done one documentary. And so I went and did it. It was wonderful. It was 3 years of fun challenges, and that was my schooling. And then in 78, I wanted to do something different, and a show from Hollywood came in called Orchard Children. I asked for a leave of absence. I said, let me go, it'd be great, I'll learn all this Hollywood stuff and bring it back. And they wouldn't give me a leave of absence, so I quit. And they said, nobody quits the CBC. And I went, well, I did. So that was 78, and 40 years later, I've been freelancing ever since.
So Beachcombers, I mean, that really was part of the very beginnings of the industry. So you've, you know, really part of carving the pathway of film and television here in BC.
Well, it was a steady position here. We didn't really know what we were doing. We just kind of winged it. But looking back at the film industry, Hollywood was here in the 30s, and they came for the, you know, the mounted police, the oceans and the mountains. But Beachcombers actually was a steady run, and who would know that it ran for 19 years? I was there in season 4, 5, and 6, and every year we never thought we'd be coming back because everything was controlled by Toronto, and they wouldn't tell us if they're going to renew or not. But it was a wonderful. I still have friends that are from the era. I learned enormous amount. And the beauty about that was that we were so small and naive. If you're doing, I guess, on the design part called set decorators, if you're in the freelance world now, we'd be doing about 10 or 12 jobs. So that gave me a really good background of all the other positions. So when I started freelancing, it started separating into different little departments. And I went, oh boy, this guy's really good. And so you would just let that person do it. And that's the philosophy I've always had, is to find the very best people and let them join your team. And it's worked for me, you know.
So for someone who's not very familiar, how does props fit in a show between costumes and set deck and all the pieces? Where is props?
Well, props is a very general term that's used in theater, film, TV. It's quite general and specific to the actual area that you're actually working in. For example, when you say props in New York for picture cars, the props people do that there. I used to do that here. Now the Teamsters do that. So generally speaking here, because we're cut from the cloth of the American system, props generally means that they're hand props that are handled by the actor, touched and used. I don't have that philosophy. That's what I generally do. I work very closely with certain set decorators, and if they have something that's in the set that works really well, I'll just use that because it has to flow and blend into it. And I'll say to the decorator, well, I'll need 2 or 3 of these or whatever. But props generally in the North America scene is what is usually handled and used by actors. So that could be a quill pen to a weapon of any kind. But I'm much more general, and certain shows I tend to like to do that if they'll allow me to do it.
And you really have taken up some very challenging shows. And your career has taken you all over the world, really. Can you talk to us about 7 years in Tibet and what that was like?
That's probably the most challenging show that I've ever done. I was gone from Vancouver for 10 months. And originally, when the producer and the director, the designer called me, we were supposed to be shooting in India. And first thing you go to the family and say, I think I'd like to go away. And that's always tension. And that's one of the balances one has to do. So I said yes. And I turned down all these other shows that were locally here. And I waited and waited. And every day, research would be coming in for FedEx Express, and I was getting my shots for India, and we're ready to go, and I was talking to all these people. And 6 weeks later, I get this phone call, because of course, there's no one's using computers. We're basically faxing and FedExing and talking on phones, and they said, oh, we just got kicked out. I go, my first thing is, do I still have a job? He said, oh, yeah, we have a job, but we don't know where we're shooting at. So what happened there was that 7 years is a story about the Dalai Lama, and Jean-Jacques was doing that, and Martin Scorsese was doing Kundun, and he got kicked out too. So we had a construction crew building in Mysore for 5 months, and the long and short of it was that the Chinese government, like they're still doing now, came to their neighbor saying, you know, we don't want to have this story told. So the permits that were promised never came. So everyone scrambled. They had the money, they had the actors, they just didn't have the location. Unbeknownst to me, what we needed was we needed the foothills of the Himalayas to recreate the Tibet look. And the only place that looks like that is the Pyrenees and the Andes. And so Scorsese's people went to Marrakesh and we had four production managers and they went and booked all the hotels. So when Marty's team came in, they couldn't shoot there. And our producers had done Wings of Courage and they knew the mountains of the Andes. So they said, it's okay. Yeah, that's what we do. We're all going to Argentina. So they shipped another shipment of tools from England, and the 50 carpenters from India went to Argentina. And Jim Erickson, the set decorator, a good friend of mine, said, look, we're out of time. We only have 5 months. So, Jimmy, don't come to India. I'll get the stuff for you. I said, Jim, I don't think so. And Jim and I in the early days had worked as props, right? So he had worked as my assistant. And I said, okay, well, you go to England and we'll meet there and you help me with the set deck because I know you can do that. So long and short of it was, Jim had the six guys over in India procuring everything. And I was a bit worried because he was procuring my props too. And I was doing a set deck in England. Our offices were in Paris. The costume department was in Italy at Cinecittà. So I was there great. It's just, you know, I was tubing to Paris for meetings and I had my own driver and we're flying over to Cinecittà for meetings. And next thing you know, 6-7 weeks later, I'm landing in Argentina by myself and Jim's still over there. I said, look, we need people. I want you to interview all these people. I said, well, what do you need? Well, we need cutters and costume people, this and this. And so I ended up interviewing about 200 people. I don't speak Spanish. And the office that the production manager from India got was one little one-bedroom studio that she was living in. That we didn't have an office. So I interviewed all these people, and Jim kind of came in and with his guys, you know, over in India. And they brought a lot of the stuff, and they hand-carried it. And I think each one of them had to pay about $10,000 overage for a lot of the stuff they're carrying. So we prepped in Argentina. We shot there. There was 22 different languages spoken. So if you told a joke, it'd be a five-minute delay. It was wonderful. You know, we had people from all over the world, and it was challenging. You know, I had another war to do. Legends of the Fall, I had 1,000 people, and this was 1940s and the Chinese against the Tibetans. And it was challenging because the Falkland Islands had just happened and the British had attacked, and a lot of the people on the crew had people that were in the army. So, and I wanted to get machine guns in from England. Well, they didn't. They gave me the permits, but they never came. So we actually used Argentine weapons and we converted them to blank firing, and we made wooden machine guns that, you know, that didn't fire, and took jeeps that we cut them up and made them look like Russian jeeps. So it was a huge challenge. And of course we had to recreate Tibet, which was wonderful in the sense that we lived with 200 Tibetans and the Dalai Lama's sister was there, and it was great. And you know, it's just a really challenging movie. And then we had to come back here and do all the mountain climbing stuff. And I wondered, why the heck aren't we doing it in the Himalayas? Well, the mountains here look just like the Tibetan mountains, over 7,000 or 8,000 feet. And plus, you can get helicopters up there. It's just too difficult to shoot there. So it was really a challenge. It's probably one of my favorite shows. And my wife is still with me after 10 months away. And the kids came down for Christmas. I have three kids. And we went had a 2 or 3 week holiday, but it's the business is wonderful, but it's a challenge on one's personal life. So that's 7 years in Tibet, and I'm quite proud of that.
That's amazing. I think that production has come up across several interviews that we've had as something that just stands out in so many people's careers.
I just sit here listening to you and just absorbing sort of all of the history. And these are movies that I watched, you know, as a kid and just in complete awe, you know, and just to know all of the elements that go behind it, and that local Canadian folks had a huge hand in making these huge films so successful. And I want to kind of know what it's like to be on a Martin Scorsese Marty name base with him.
It was Jean-Jacques. With Marty, the only relationship I had with him, I was asked to do Silence. And I was doing I guess it's called Man of Steel, Superman, and I met the designer and the producer, and Marty couldn't get enough money for it. And they said, well, Marty's in town on this day, he'd like to meet you. And I said, what day is that? He says, well, it's the Tuesday. And I went, oh, I'm really sorry. I, I can't do it. It's the first day of shooting in Chicago, and I wouldn't do it. So that's the only relationship I have with Marty. It was
oh, having to turn down a date with Martin Scorsese. Yeah. Ah. That's really, though, a testament. You have worked the trenches from Beachcombers through most of everything that Zack Snyder has shot here with some really big, incredible shows, and probably everything in between. Can you talk about what might be a smaller show or a gem of a show that you're just so proud to have worked on and what that was like, the differences?
I guess for name drop wise, it was always great doing the little TV movies when my kids were younger. And my all-time favorite director is George Schaefer. And I worked the first show when I left the CBC with him, and I ended up doing 5 movies. And the little gems is that I had a chance to work with Katharine Hepburn twice. And that was really, really sweet. And to see such a legend be just a nice, hardworking professional was just wonderful.
So what does a day in the life of a prop master look like?
Long hours. I'm usually in the office in prep about 7, and I get to go home around 6, about 10 hours. On a good day, I might go home sooner, but it's usually about 10 or 12 hours. And a prop master, you know, is in charge of just one of the departments. And there's basically 3 phases to the job. It's prep, shooting, and wrap. So the prep part of it is after I accept the job, because it's wonderful, you take the script and you break it down and you research it and you find people who can help you research. Those days we didn't have the internet, so you'd have to go to the Cyclopedia or the Smithsonian. So that's the fun part. And you have to interface with the different departments, who's doing what, and follow the designs of the costume designer and the production designer, and work with the set decorator and talk about with the effects of how we're going to do this and what it can be and what should I do. And you know, you get beat up over the money and the budget and all that stuff, and so it's getting thicker bureaucratically through the studios and the legal, but that's all part of it. As long as they realize that we're there to try to make a movie with whatever restrictions there are in time and money. So I find that the fun part, because I've gone to England, I've gone to different places to look and to find things, make sure they're correct. And for example, we had a climbing scene and I needed climbing equipment from the 30s. So I went to the museum in London, and dusty little place in the basement. And this is, oh, this would do. I said, what's that? That's Edmund Hillary's climbing pick from climbing Mount Everest. You know, and things like that are just wonderful. So I just had to find some place to manufacture 40 of those. And there's all kinds of wonderful little excerpts and places, and being down in Tahiti working, and you don't know anybody, and you have a day off and you're working with certain people, and you're walking down the thing and say, hey, Jimmy, we're having a wedding. Come on in. Oh, huh? And so, you know, how do you get that? You can't do that on a package tour, and you get to meet all the locals. And I remember I did a shopping scene for Little Women. I ended up going to 200 antique stores, finding props, 1860s. And my driver, we got caught in the snowstorm. He says, well, I can't get you back to the hotel. Why don't you just spend the night with us? He lived in this wonderful little salt box house. It's from 400 years ago. And he says, oh, we didn't expect you. We're going to go out for dinner. So we went to this little place that all the locals hang out. There's people playing music, and the family and kids running around. There's all this homemade food, and you get to see all the locals. And you know, it's like, that's what's kind of like really, really wonderful. And the other aspect of it is the shooting. The shooting could be anywhere, but that's what it's all about. You're bringing whatever you are to one particular scene, and it's helping tell the story. You're working with actors to make sure they're very comfortable, that they're being a pen or a gun. It drives me crazy. I see these shows all the time, and they never put weights in suitcases. And it's like, you know, if they don't have a weight in suitcases, the actor should act it. I mean, something, it just takes away from the performance. So I always weigh all the suitcases, and my guys go, oh, and the actors go, well, we'll take some out. But at least they don't have to worry about it. You know, they have that tension on one side of the arm. Those little details. And a lot of times, you know, we make wonderful, beautiful props. They're designed, they're all okayed, and the actor likes it, the director likes it. And you look at the scene and the actor is just stumbling around trying to fix this thing. And it's like, hey, $30,000, and months later, just take it away and give him a coffee cup. Because it's not important. But sometimes that prop, it just says something that conveys what you're trying to do, what the script is trying to do, what the actor is going to do. For example, Snow Falling on Cedars, it's a murder mystery, and all the little clues and featured, and, you know, and working with actors is fine because you have to get them comfortable with what they have. Certain actors are great. Alec Dreen was a wonderful stunt guy here, and he had him on Catwoman with Halle Berry doing whips, and, you know, 3 months of training, the producers said, oh, it's too dangerous, get rid of him. So, you know, stuff like that. And he came out to Alberta to do Shanghai Noon, and he had Jackie Chan and Owen Wilson doing these guns. Jackie picked up the stuff and just spinning around thing. We gave it to Owen, and we had a trainer in Texas for him. We had another trainer down in LA, but I don't think he worked very hard. He came up here and he was doing his stuff, and it was like, oh, okay, Jimmy, bring the guns out again tomorrow. So we did this for 3 weeks, and finally I went to the director, and I said, geez, you know, I don't know if you're going to be happy with Owen. Why don't you come down and take a look? So he came down and looked, and he was just stumbling around, and I don't know if it's my idea or it's his idea, but I think it was my idea, but I didn't get the credit for it. He says, why don't you ask Owen to play it like he's a con? Like he really can't do it, but he's just, you know, kind of like, you know, big like he can do it. Yeah, that's a good idea. So sometimes something that doesn't work works in the show.
I want to circle to something that you said just then, because you bring so much meaning to every single item that the actor is going to touch. And when we interviewed Jim Erickson, who sings your praises to the moon and back, you know, it doesn't surprise me that you guys worked well together, because there's so much crossover between the thoughtfulness of him putting, you know, an actual book from the Lincoln Library on Lincoln's desk.
Right.
And the things that you do, you bring some pretty deep meaning to the entire story.
Thanks for Jim for saying that. And Jim's a very good friend of mine. When I was a decorator at CBC, he was assigned to my crew. And I looked at him and said, this guy is, has a lot of potential. Couldn't get in the union in set deck in those days. There were only three people in set deck. So it was kind of like, can't get in. So I was chairman of the prop department at that time. And I said, Jim, I know you don't want to do props, but come and do a show with me, right? So he did a show and he got his qualifications and he got into props. And then the union said, we want to have individual departments now in meetings. And I said, oh. And the art directors and the set decorators didn't want to do that. And I, having been a set decorator and art director, I said, well, I'll chair that. So we had a three-way chair. I was chairman of the set decorator props and art directors. And I had art director. I have two art directing credits and features. And it was a small group of people. You know, when I joined the union, it was 54 people.
Wow. And now if you include our retirees and our permittees, we're about 15,000.
Oh, my God. And so anyway, I was chairing a meeting and I said, you know, I think I won't mention a name, but there's one set decorator at the meeting. And I said, you know, Jim really would rather do set deck. Is it okay that he switches department? And everybody put up their hand, and the one set decorator left, and the next week they formed their own department. So Jim was in, and then I did a show with Doug Higgins, one of my mentors, a wonderful man, and there was Gray Fox and all this other stuff happening in town, and we had kids, and the wife says, oh, you shouldn't go. And then Doug asked me, why don't you come and art direct this show in Alberta? It was with James Gardner. It's called Pure Escape. We shot for 10 weeks and we prepped for 12, and then it ran out of money and never got finished. But Doug asked me to hire the whole crew, and I said, okay, fine. So you hire everybody, okay, construction, special effects in Alberta and all that, and hire the best people you know. So I hired Jim Erickson. When Jim came out there, Doug marched to my office and says, what are you doing? I asked you to hire the best person you know. What about the people in Los Angeles and Toronto? He says, I don't know them. I just know them by reputation. So that was Jim's first set decorating job. And years later, two Academy Award nominations and one win. Mm-hmm. Good for him.
Good instincts.
Yeah.
So what would you say to someone, how would you guide them if they were trying to get into the department? What would be your piece of advice for them? Where would you steer them?
Props is a really unusual department in the sense that everyone looks at it and says, oh, it's fun, that's easy. Of all the departments, like for costumes and set deck and art department, it's a design portion. So every show is a little different. And with props is that your life experiences really helps you. So if you're older and you have other experiences, it helps you. It's mainly just basically attitude too, and finding the right team to work with. So you have to get a start somewhere. And I don't know how people start now. I know how I started, and I know how other people started, and the prop department is unusual. We have people who are lawyers and chefs, and they come from all different backgrounds. So I just say, you know, try to meet as many people as you can, you know, work on a commercial, do whatever you can, go to school, and hopefully, you know, there'll be an opening and you can get a chance to work with someone and try to find somebody that'll spend the time with you. Props is difficult in the sense that we're not that big, in the sense that if you're in set deck, there's different jobs and you can kind of interchange. When I did props, a lot of times when I was first hired in certain shows, I'd come out and he says, well, what is my assistant? What do you mean an assistant? This is it. This is a TV series. It was Huckleberry Finn and the producer, Bob Stabler, who did, you know, the Mule Team in L.A. He says, you only need one person in props. So that's, and now there's 10, right? There's truck people and all this other stuff. But it's an unusual job in the sense, and I just try to help people and introduce them to different people, and hopefully they give them a break. And it comes down with attitude too, and how things are. And I'm hearing stories about new people right now, and unfortunately we're growing so fast they haven't had the chance to experience other things, and they're in one little pocket. For example, they're saying, I'm a truck person, and my answer is, what is a truck person?
Yeah.
So it never used to exist, but there are positions now where they just are in the truck and they prep and they fix and they do this and that. And it's a job where you have to be very versatile, or else, like myself, I can only do certain things. I realize that, oh my God, let's get Brad in here. He can do this much better than I can, you know.
That's one of the best traits of being a head of department. You know, you said one of the characteristics that make you good at your craft are knowing your limits and restrictions. So what do you look for in your crew around you?
People always say to me, you know, hey, we got a job for you. I just got an offer after 2 years. And people say, why didn't you take it? And I go, well, let's put it this way, use it as an analogy as I'm the hockey coach and I need a good goalie, I need a defenseman, you know, and I need a forward line. That's just the players. And behind that, there's people who are taking care of the equipment, the chiropractic. It's the same thing in this job. You can't do it all yourself. On Warcraft, we had 30 people in the shop. And I don't know why they brought the show here, because it was too expensive in England. They have all kinds of different departments there in England, the cobbler's department. I go, what the heck is that? Well, the cobbler's department is not a shoe department. It's a department that makes bricks, so they're rubber. So when the horses go over, it doesn't make any noise. And they have armory's department, you know, armors that just do the weapons, and other people would just do horse armor. Well, we don't have a horse armor department. Everyone says, who's doing the horse armor? Everybody stood back, and here's me standing in the prop department. So we ended up doing horse armor. And so, you know, people-wise, you get the best. So I have some contacts down at Weta. We couldn't do all the weapons here. All the prop shops were disappointed, but I said, you know, I need so many so quickly. We spent $1 million down at Weta. And the horse armor, Richard down there, we were talking, we were Zooming, and he emails me. He says, Jimmy, do you realize how difficult that is? And I says, no. So he says, I'll send a couple of people up from New Zealand for you. I said, no, it's okay. I'll see what I can do. So the art director was fabulous, and he had contacts over in England. And we actually sent two prop makers from England, and they had pre-molded certain things. So the challenge is that we're doing the horse armor. So you got to go, well, we're putting horse armor on horses that the wrangler and the coordinator haven't decided which horses are going to use. And I'm sitting there going, yeah, but I have to measure these horses like a custom-made suit, right? And someone says, no, well, Jimmy, you don't have to do that, because we tried to measure them and we didn't know which the horses. Someone said, just scan them. I said, what? Scan them. I said, okay. So I phoned the scan guy and he says, have you ever scanned horses before? He says, no. He says, how the hell do you get them to stand still? And there's hair and all this other stuff. So we somehow scanned them, sent them off to England, and they had other pre-made molds. We came back here and then we had the fabulous team. We put them all back together here. And then we have buyers. You have to go search for different things. You have chain mail. So where do you find chain mail? Of all places, we found in Saskatchewan. Yeah. So it's kind of strange that way.
How have you seen the changes in technology in the motion picture industry affect the props department with the increase in visual effects and digital components? How has that affected how the department works?
Well, quite radically. And when we did 7 years, we had the visual effects people just travel with us. And they just did measurements. And then Jim Erickson had done Independence Day, and he was telling me this story. He says, you know, we had this scene on the roof here, and all they wanted was one table with dressing on it, and the rest was just green. I said, Jim, what do you mean green? It's like chroma key? Yeah, they didn't want anything. So from there, it's evolved. So sometimes it's good. It's efficient if it enhances the story. But other times, it's really quite difficult for actors, too. Because, you know, because they physically can't handle or feel something. And actors want that and need that. So, you know, I always tell the story about in 7 years, Brad Pitt had a knife. It was a native knife, and he was doing damage with it. So in order to do what he did, you know, we have a briefcase. So I had it made it down to Los Angeles. We had the knife that was picked, the real knife, the sharp knife, the aluminum knife, the rubber knife, the hard rubber knife, the soft rubber knife, the retractable knife. He's going to cut someone over. We have a little tube with a blood lead for a left-handed cut, a right-handed cut. Well, flash ahead to now, you just give an actor a green stick.
Oh, yes.
So that is good and it's bad. You know, it's safer, it's better, but, you know, but he has to act, you know, and actors need stuff, you know. I mean, especially the people that are my favorite and best actors, they usually come from stage and they do their own props, they're doing their own hair, their makeup, and they just appreciate all the things you have, you know. And these young actors are, you know, they have their hand out and where's my stuff? And they say, well, here it is, you know. And where'd you put it? It says, oh, it's over in the table, you know.
It's like actors taking their rings or their watches home, their prop rings or their watches or their glasses, right?
That's where we have doubles and triples.
Can you think of something that is like the craziest moment of your career? Maybe there's several.
I can't think of a moment, but I can think of a lot of challenges where I go, how the blankety blank am I supposed to do that with the amount of money and time that they have? So in 7 years, we have horses, and there's a certain species, and they're quite short and stout, and they have long manes. So we have actors that are riding this. And so we actually snuck into Tibet and shot secretly with the mountains in the background with these actors riding as doubles, right, with the props and the saddles and all that stuff. So that's one scene. We have another scene where we have the same
horse. Wait a minute. Let's just back up a little bit.
Okay.
How does
just
one
casually snuck into Tibet?
How does one sneak into Tibet? How does that work?
I won't mention any names, but he's a still documentary photographer, and he was there shooting something, and they allowed him to come in. Mm-hmm. We gave him pictures of a certain type of horse that we're looking for. He established the horse. Mm-hmm. And then we had saddles that were made and certain packs and certain costumes and little sticks. So they didn't know what he was doing. He was just shooting something. So that was traveling shots, left to right, right to left, sunrise, uphill, whatever. And so the director loved it. He said, oh, that's great. It's beautiful, beautiful. So we're going to match to that. So then I did the horses and the airplanes and the cars in 7 years. Not props, but I mean, that's what I think it should be, but we had to find a horse that matched it. So we went to a ranch and the guy went through the thing. So we found a horse that matched it. We had to paint it a little bit, but it was fine. And then what happens, it's Mr. Pitt, Brad Pitt. So he's now trapped with the Campas or something. So he escapes on this particular horse. Now it's another scene. So he cuts through this tent that we had to make, and he hops on the horse and he rides off. So that's the third horse in Canada now. And then what happens is that he rides so hard, he rides it to death. It's like the scene in Revenant. I prep Revenant, and so I'm familiar with it. And so the horse dies, and he cuts it and gets in it, and he actually eats it. So we're out of money, and we're in Canada back here shooting him at Waddington, and the producer and director says, Jimmy, we need this horse, but, you know, we're out of money. You can only do this. Well, I don't listen, you know, and so I go and get Danny Virtue, and he says, Danny, I says, you know, I know you know the animals, and they're all going to the glue factory, and I says, could you pick one out for me that looks like this and kind of save it? So I took it to the taxidermist. We had it made. Then we had to get food made so Brad could cut into it and eat it. So that was four horses that were kind of like, how the hell are you going to do that? And they did. And the producers were yelling at me. He says, don't make a head. Don't make a wolf. We'll just have the body. And I said, no. Jean-Jacques, how can you do that? He says, you're going to be in a helicopter. You're going to be zooming down. You have one person and a horse. And it's okay, Jimmy. We'll just do that. Well, I don't listen, you know. And I've been threatened to be fired a lot of times. And I usually get rehired again because I don't have a history of going over budget. But I think he really, really needed this. And I said, Yeah, okay, we'll do what we can. So all of a sudden the horse comes with the head and the legs. It's, oh, wonderful. Mm-hmm. So he made a shot wide. He came in, and that's one. And I'm sure there's other ones, but I can't remember anymore.
So I'm still not sure how you quite got into Tibet, but that's okay, because it led into quite a good story about Brad Pitt inside of the guts of horse.
Well, between that and painting the horse and then eating the horse, I think we got there somehow.
Yeah, but horses aren't props usually. They're usually done by the wranglers. But
you mentioned Danny Virtue, and just for anyone listening, Danny Virtue's a legend in this industry, in stunts and also with all of the animal work that he does. It's pretty incredible.
Incredible guy. Yeah. No, he's a true pioneer. I mean, you know, this, Danny, what are you doing? You can't do that. Oh yeah, we're going to do it. We're going to do a studio of this, and I'll do the high fall and some show. Okay. No, he's quite the character.
It's so fascinating. You know, you talked about the diverse skill set you have to have, and back in the day, managing different departments. And really, you know, and I'll circle back to what I said earlier in the interview, it's folks like you and like Danny and like Jim Erickson and Glenn Campbell and a whole small group of you that really laid the foundations for the success in the film industry now. And I, for one, appreciate you.
Thank you.
Yeah. Really, you're one of the most memorable props person I've ever worked with.
It was a good movies. We worked on Sucker Punch and Watchmen. Mm-hmm. It was great. You know, it's wonderful. Zach's a wonderful director. It's just, it's great.
What's the balance for someone going into props between, you know, searching and searching and searching and hoping you'll find the right thing in some antique store or someone's cupboard, and just having to knuckle down and make it?
It's a hard decision. You have to just kind of look at what the object is and how important it is. You know, I work for the studio, and so there's a time restriction, how much money is allocated to the department, and if they'll allow me to split it up. You know, some producers think they know everything. This is, well, you know, that a figurine shouldn't be more than $1,200. Sometimes you just go around the corner and you find it. And other times you go, oh my God, I'm going to have to make this. In Argentina, I was trying to help the costume designer. A lot of times the costumes, all the webbing you props people do. We needed canteens. We saw they had the research of the canteens the Chinese armies were using in the late 40s. And they're quite prominent. So, you know, everyone's going to have it. It's a big bulge. And I said, I'm not going to do this. I said, I got to go have a coffee. So I went and had a coffee and I walked in the hardware store and I did a double take. And there it was. On the shelf, and I got my interpreter to come in and says, ask him how many he has. He says, he has 20. He says, can he get 300? And he says, yeah. He says, how long? He says, well, maybe 3 weeks. And they were like $3. And I said, if I buy 300, can I have them for $2 each? And big pause. And so we negotiated that down to $2.25. I think I gave him $2.50 because I was so happy. $2.50. So you don't know. If you want to hear another story, I'll tell you another prop story.
Yes, please.
There's a scene in 7 Years where Heinrich Harrer and his partner. They've escaped from India and now they're in Tibet and they're heading towards Lhasa. And they finally stumble upon this marketplace. It's like a foreshadowing. They actually see an old Chinese soldier shirt there, and they look at it and they pull and they tug it. And they want it. They're going to try it on or whatever they're going to do. And we hadn't shot the scene with all the 300 Chinese soldiers. And I was over in Rome and Cinecittà with Enrico, and the designer says, you know, hey, when you get your shirt, could you just give me a shirt? And they say, okay, we'll get you one. So he gives me the shirt, and it's brand new. And they have like 30 people running around. They're trying to dress everybody, and it's the first day. And they have aging machines. Like they use cement mixers with rocks, and they put water, and they throw the clothes in, they smash it all up. And sorry, Jimmy, we can't help you. You've got to go do it yourself. I said, but it's going to be a major thing. They say, oh, no, you do it, you go. So we're back up on the hills. The first day of shoot, it's a crazy little scene where there's going to be 200 Tibetans up there. And you can see right now there's hundreds of paparazzi. It's the first day of shoot, right? Paul Mulder is a good friend of mine who's been with me for years, and Catherine Layton has been also with me, and we're up there trying to get the things ready for the scene. Paul and I are scrubbing away at this thing, trying to make this brand new shirt look old, and we look at each other and says, it's not going to happen, Paul. And Catherine's there doing this stuff, and says, Catherine, could you drop what you're doing and help us out here? You have to go to the laundromat. She comes back 3 hours later and says, I went to the laundromat. They couldn't do this. They couldn't do that. So she goes down to the hotel where we're staying at and talks to the manager. The manager shuts down the whole laundry facility. She throws the stuff in and she washes it all and gets it all done. Finally, the sun's going down. She comes back and I look at it and it's just thrashed. The green has gone out of it. There's brown coming through us. Oh. What are we going to do? Because it's a major prop. He's supposed to pick it up, right? So it's getting dark. We go back and all the British crew sitting there drinking away, and the technical crew and the camera guys are having a good, start shooting tomorrow. Yeah, you know, we're still working away. I says, we got to go. We got to show them what this is. So I meekly kind of go in and talk to Laurence. I said, I got to see your designer. And I said, oh, Enrico's very busy. He's dressing so-and-so. It's important to us. We'll wait. So finally he comes out. He goes, hey, Jimmy, how are you? Nice to see you. I said, do you remember in Rome when I said we needed that shirt? Yeah, Pedro, we gave it to you, right? Yeah. I got it. And I says, well, I just want to show you what we did, and then we probably need another one. So give him the shirt, and Catherine and I are standing back there, and he looks at it. He goes, dead silence. And he goes, Beautiful. Pedro, Ron, Galora, come on, come in here. Everybody come here. You see how this is a shirt? I want all the uniforms just to look at this. And what had happened is that they had the shirts made in India and they dyed it green. And with all the stuff is that the green came off and the brown was underneath. So, you know, so sometimes another happy accident.
I feel like whichever streaming company owns 7 years in Tibet right now or is running it owes you a little bit of promotion dollars there. You just have such incredible stories.
Well, that's one of my, I guess, most challenging, wonderful 10 months of my life. You're just involved in this relationship and it's 5-6 days a week, 10, 12 hours. All you do is do the job and you're very happy if you're the people that you come in every day, you see, you really enjoy. And the seventh day, you just kind of recuperate.
So looking ahead, mm-hmm. I know you've mentioned you turned down a few really big shows. What would it take for Zack Snyder or Marty or Steven Spielberg to get you back on a set?
Well, I worked with Steven on BFG and I kind of, oh, geez, I wish they would have called me for a West Side Story, but they didn't. I don't think I'm going to go back. You know, I'm in my mid-70s, and it's quite excruciating physically. I know I have a lot of friends who just don't retire. You know, they're 90 years old, and they're still costume designing. There's, you know, Clint Eastwood, you know, they'll drag him off the set. But I don't want to do that. I've had a wonderful time. I've met good people, and it's such a big commitment to do a movie well, and I don't think I could give it 100% anymore. And plus the fact that I only can do it if I have the people that I work with. And that's really, really important, you know, because you need your researchers. And like Catherine's been with me for like 30 years and she's still kind of going at it. And you need really good set people. It's really, really important how they do it. And the producers and the legal and how everything has evolved with Netflix and all these Amazon. You have people in key positions and they're not like the old folks. I mean, the guys who are the producers, they came through the old system and they started producing after 20 or 30 years. These kids are bright, brilliant people with MBAs that are coming to make movies. And I just feel they just don't have the understanding of what it really takes to do it. But who am I to say? I'm sure that's been with every industry and every evolution with certain things. My next little interview, I guess I'm doing a Zoom for the Academy. I'm doing a career day down there. You know, because I'm a member of the Academy, I get to watch like 40 or 50 movies a year at home. And I miss it, though, you know, and I like to help out if anybody can. There's a wonderful show right now called Shogun. A lot of my crew I used to work with are on there and give them some of my supplies that I still have in my shop. But other than that, you know, they're doing well. And for me, I don't think I'll be going back. But, you know, I shouldn't say never, but it'd have to be really something really, really special. And maybe I get, you know, a couple people kind of prop me, but just carry me around a little bit.
I'm sure there would be a lineup around the block of people in the props department waiting to interview with you if you did. So,
you know, and quite happy. Yeah, I'm quite busy. So I'm quite active and I'm waiting for the snow to come back so I can get back on the ski slope, you know, so.
Amazing.
Well, Jimmy, thank you so much for sharing pretty well the history of Vancouver film with us, as well as your own experience. It's such a beautiful tapestry of what this industry has been built on. So thanks again.
Okay, you're very welcome.
And that's a wrap for another episode of Apple Box Talks.
For more episodes and to find your fit in the film and TV industry, check out ourwork.ca.